WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. A Charlottesville nonprofit is taking a leading role in opposing the proposed massive Dominion merger. It's not just weed that can get you high. Hemp products are increasingly more potent than allowed under Virginia law. And we go bat watching at Harrisonburg's EJC Arboretum. This is the WMRA Daily for Wednesday, July 22nd. Tuesday evening was a night of tornado warnings in the Shenandoah Valley and along the Alleghenies as severe storms moved through our area. The National Weather Service says there was one confirmed tornado that touched down in Pendleton County. WHSV reports county emergency officials observed tree damage that was likely from a tornado, and there was at least one eyewitness account of a tornado last night. A Charlottesville-based lobbying group aimed at countering Dominion Energy's influence on state politics is calling foul on the utility's merger application with Florida's NextEra Energy. Charlottesville nonprofit Clean Virginia claims the utilities did not provide sufficient information to regulators on the proposal as required by state law. If their appeal is upheld by state regulators, Dominion and NextEra could be required to provide more information, and regulators could get some additional time on their six-month deadline in the case. The Virginia Mercury reports that two Republican state lawmakers from Roanoke on Tuesday urged Governor Abigail Spanberger to call a special legislative session that would allow a vote to extend the review period. The General Assembly this year passed a law that allowed Immigration and Customs Enforcement to work with local police agencies only if they adhered to certain limits. The federal government challenged the law in court, but Virginia officials are getting some backup on their arguments from a group that says the agreements can be costly, Radio IQ's Brad Kuttner reports.
Under the new law, ICE must name federal agents working with local law enforcement. They can't make arrests at schools, churches, or courthouses, nor can they make information demands of other state agencies if the info doesn't impact their immigration work. These are a few of the requirements the law's author, Fairfax Democratic Senator Saddam Saleem, said were needed in the wake of the federal agency's recent headline making.
Folks have gotten shot and killed, and then the administration will lie to us and tell us they were attacking the ICE agents. And then, of course, there's always a video that comes out that contradicts what they're saying.
Enter Alex Cornia from the Legal Aid Justice Center. He and his group filed a friend of the court brief in the ongoing legal challenge. Among their concerns, the local cost of what he calls the agency's recklessness.
Who gets sued is not ICE in a case when local law enforcement is acting as ICE. It's local law enforcement directly. And this is a massive potential risk to the state that the state has no control over.
ICE argues in court filings that, quote, states have no authority to regulate federal government operations. But Cornia says it's something a lot less exciting, a contract dispute.
Can the state regulate its own contracts? And is 287G in fact voluntary, or is the state required to take the United States terms without being able to set out any of its own terms in return?
A federal judge in Richmond will hear oral arguments in the case in early August. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
New data from the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association show that in 2025, more than 400,000 people paid out of pocket for emergency room visits. That's a four-year high. People who chose to self-pay at the ER either did not have insurance or did not give proof of insurance for their care. The association's data analytics team said in a statement that the upward trend precedes pending federal healthcare changes that could cause more people to lose or drop insurance coverage. It is not your parents' weed. Today's hemp products can be much more potent than allowed under state law. So what guardrails are in place? And what's left to chance? WMRA's Sarah Prince examined a legal Virginia hemp product with the help of an independent lab.
When you buy a hemp product in Virginia, a gummy, vape cartridge, or smokable flower, you might assume someone tested it before it reached the shelf. Broadly speaking, that's true, but whether those tests tell consumers what's actually in a product depends on the laboratory and the standards it follows. At Green Analytics in Richmond, technicians test medical cannabis and commercial hemp products. National Director of Operations Shannon Hoffman says medical cannabis testing faces stricter requirements.
Because the Commonwealth of Virginia has certain requirements for medical cannabis testing that we have to follow.
Virginia requires smokable and edible hemp products to include certificates of analysis, or COAs, from laboratories accredited under the ISO IEC 17025 International Standard for lab equipment calibration. But that accreditation only verifies a lab's competence, not that every result is accurate. Differences in testing methods and sample preparation can produce different results. Recently, an accredited Virginia laboratory tested hemp flower purchased from a Virginia retailer and provided their analysis to WMRA on the condition of anonymity. The analysis highlights a major challenge in hemp regulation. Under the 2018 Farm Bill, hemp was defined by its low delta-9 THC. But because the law did not account for THCA, a compound that converts to an intoxicant when heated, products with high THCA were able to be sold legally as hemp. Virginia addressed that loophole in 2023 by adopting what is called a total THC standard. The anonymous lab analysis found the sample contained illegally high levels of both THC and THCA, elevated moisture levels, microbial contamination, and the pesticide microbutanil. Michelle Peace, a Virginia Commonwealth University researcher who studies cannabis science, says findings like these are not unusual and pose health risks to consumers.
Just a brief case study. We had somebody brought us a product where it was purchased in one town, and it was three girls who then drove to Richmond and to an outdoor concert, and all three of them shared this one joint. And one of the girls started having seizures so bad that the lead singer of the concert saw her, stopped the concert, and got her medical attention. After we tested it, you know, we found that the THC concentration was much higher than what was actually on the label, and it had microbiologicals in it. We have to stop denying that people are having adverse events from consuming high concentrations of these products.
Dr. Chris Holsteg, director of UVA's Blue Ridge Poison Center, says the dose makes the poison, as quoted by the 15th century toxicologist Paracelsus. The theorem still holds true today and is a concern for Dr. Holsteg, with research showing increased exposure leading to increased toxicity.
What really worries me is a lot of those studies were done with people who are smoking cannabis products that have had lower content. And we certainly have been watching the content increase as time has gone on.
The sample tested for this story contained microbutanil, a pesticide that converts to toxic hydrogen cyanide gas if smoked or vaped.
There is definitely a problem with pesticides being burned. And, you know, at the end of the day, if the consumer is not aware and able to make decisions as to what they actually put into their bodies, that's problematic.
P says another concern is inconsistent testing. Laboratories may prepare samples differently, making results difficult to compare. Virginia has expanded inspections and tightened testing and labeling requirements for many hemp products. But researchers say enforcement nationwide has not kept pace with the growing market.
I would venture to say that most states have not hired scientists to actually monitor and oversee a laboratory regulatory process and to see if there is veracity to an accreditation, because it's so complicated.
One laboratory test cannot tell us what's on every shelf in Virginia, but researchers say this sample illustrates a broader problem. Without consistent testing standards and stronger oversight, consumers may not know whether a hemp product's label or the testing behind it can be trusted. For WMRA News, I'm Sarah Prince.
Find a longer version of this report with links to more information at WMRA.org and on our app. Adults in Virginia who are adopted as children can now access their birth certificates without obtaining a court order first. Under a new Virginia law, which took effect earlier this month, adoptees are able to obtain a copy by submitting an application, providing identification, and paying a fee to the Virginia Department of Health Office of Vital Records. VDH said the Vital Records Office expects a high volume of requests based on years of inquiries it could not fulfill under the previous law. A new state law explicitly bans Virginia drivers from live streaming behind the wheel, even if the streaming device is mounted. Drivers who violate the law could have their license suspended and face up to a $500 fine if they're involved in an accident at the time of the violation. Law enforcement officers still need a pretext for the stop, such as driving erratically. They cannot stop a driver solely for live streaming. Virginia is still growing, although the pace is slowing. Radio IQ's Michael Pope has the numbers.
Here's the projection from the University of Virginia.
The U.S. population is projected to continue growing, but at a slower pace.
That's Sol Beck, a senior researcher at the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service.
The speed of the population growth is slowing down, mainly due to the slow birth and population aging.
Virginia currently has about 8.9 million people, and that population is expected to grow to 9.5 million by 2050. So that's growth, but a sluggish pace compared to the baby boom that happened after World War II, which created an echo boom of millennials.
The baby boomer generation will all be over 65 by 2030. So that's why we still have some growth, but the growth rate reduces between 2030 to 2040. So that's why the total population growth rate is declining over time.
One trend identified by the latest numbers, the South is capturing a growing share of the population, expanding from 38% in 2020 to 43% by 2050. I'm Michael Pope.
The bats of James Madison University's Arboretum are the main attraction at a bi-monthly event where visitors watch the winged mammals emerge for their evening hunt. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
The Edith J. Carrier Arboretum is a home and hunting ground for several bat species: eastern reds, tricolors, silvers, and big browns. Bat enthusiasts gathered by the pond at dusk last Friday to watch them. Peggy Plass, a JMU professor and Virginia Master Naturalist, held an acoustic monitoring device hooked up to her phone.
So it's better to have it higher, but it's lightning. It picks up the echolocation that the bats are doing, and different bat species echolocate at different frequencies.
So incoming thunderstorms and maybe the haze from wildfire smoke subdued their activity this night, but we saw a few.
Oh, there it is, right there. That's a bat right there. You see it right there?
Here comes another.
Oh, yay!
Amazing.
Okay, yeah, that's a red bat.
Lindsay Caesar, an assistant professor of chemistry at JMU, researches the microbiome of bat skin. A fungal disease called white nose syndrome has decimated bat populations in some caves, but certain species are more resilient than others.
Yeah, we've been kind of delving deeper into individual bacteria that live on the skin of bats and trying to understand how they're actually killing the fungus that causes white nose syndrome. So at least one of the strains makes very potent antifungal molecules.
She noted that cavers should be careful to decontaminate their gear between trips to protect delicate subterranean ecosystems. The Evening with Bats events, hosted by the Virginia Master Naturalists and the Bat Conservation and Rescue of Virginia, take place on the first and third Friday of every month through September. Find more information on the Arboretum's website. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
We have that link at WMRA.org and on our app. Full disclosure, WMRA's operating license is held by JMU's Board of Visitors. Increasing the state's tree canopy could offer a range of benefits: cooling temperatures, reducing storm runoff, and improving air quality, among others. But between 2018 and 2023, Virginia's tree canopy was effectively unchanged, going from 16.6 million to 16.8 million acres, just up slightly. Radio IQ's Dave Cantor has more.
The Forest Land and Urban Tree Canopy Conservation Plan Advisory Committee was created through state legislation in 2020. It's supposed to assess tree cover and how to retain or expand it. But competing priorities across business, government, and conservation complicate the issue. That's according to Cherie Shannon, a member of the panel and a co-founder of Southside Relief, a Richmond environmental justice nonprofit.
What's important for us to figure out at this TAC meeting is to define the type of forest that we have in Virginia. For us to recognize what is the optimal performance that we need from our forests across the Commonwealth. What resources do we need to put in place? Financial support, physical infrastructure, social infrastructure, education, whatever, all those pieces.
Since localities across the state have different needs and disparate levels of tree canopy, there's not an easy state-level fix. Most local governments don't have staff focused on the issue, resulting in some officials being unaware of what kind of tree cover exists within their communities and what benefits it offers. Compounding the potential impacts of the state's unchanged canopy are utility projects and a national discussion over the roadless rule, which could enable logging on federal forest lands like the George Washington and Jefferson National Forests. I'm Dave Cantor.
Finally today, pediatricians warn that too much time on tablets, smartphones, or other devices can lead to multiple problems for children and adolescents, but few studies show exactly how this translates to school-based learning. During the pandemic, most schools began using more technology, even for some of the youngest students. But in the Southwest Virginia county of Pulaski, one high school student is advocating to change that. Also with Radio IQ, Roxy Todd reports.
Willow Elliott spent her middle school years during the COVID-19 pandemic. And like most of her peers, schoolwork suddenly shifted to screen-based learning.
It's so easy to just Google answers and get assignments done really quick, and that's not helping anybody learn. That's not going to help us when we get to college and get out into the real world.
Now she's a senior at Pulaski County High School. Last year, she was selected to participate in the Southwest Virginia Governor's School. And as part of that experience, she realized something about taking notes during class.
Whenever I can handwrite it, I think it stays in my mind more. It's more relevant in my brain, and I can easily access it.
Elliot began digging more into why screens may not be as effective as using pen and paper. She also interviewed her peers. A majority said, like her, they retain information better when they handwrite notes or read something in a book versus a screen. Then she took her findings to the Pulaski County School Board and asked that teachers assign more work off screens.
I want the return of paper-based learning. I think it helps students and eliminates distractions.
There is research to support what Elliot observed. Rosanna Breaux is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Virginia Tech.
We know that there are differences in if you are physically reading a book versus reading it on a tablet or listening to it in terms of how much you are actually comprehending and remembering from it.
Pulaski County School Superintendent Rob Graham says Elliot's presentation impressed the school board.
You know, we valued that and looked at it and went back to our leadership team and said, this is something that we really want to investigate. And, you know, it turns out that we need to move in that direction.
Graham says for the past year, the school board had already been exploring how much classroom time should be spent using Chromebooks. Cost is one issue, but so is the research that shows many young people are struggling with mental health challenges, partly as a result of heavy screen time. When Elliot presented her PowerPoint, he says it made them take the issue even more seriously.
We also are well aware that the amount of use of the screen time does not enhance your ability to be a critical thinker or be a creative thinker or be a effective communicator or somebody who values collaboration.
But Pulaski schools aren't throwing technology out completely. They're going slowly, beginning by eliminating most screen time for pre-K, kindergarten, and first grades.
We have a lot of funding spent on technology, so we don't want to wipe it all away, and we do understand the value that it has in our classrooms. But it should be used more supplementally than being the priority for our teachers.
Graham says they're also emphasizing more project-based learning and assignments that encourage students to work in a team. Research suggests that if teachers do use screens, it's better to use the technology interactively, says Breaux.
So rather than having each student have the learning up on their own device, having maybe the larger one, and then there might be a breakout afterwards or practice with it. But when we're using screens, it's still done in a social, interactive way, and there's still facilitated learning.
Rose says there are some indications that screen-based learning can help some students, including adaptive technologies for students with learning disabilities. And some kids just prefer to read on a screen. Willow Elliott agrees there is some use for technology in the classroom. But if students have access to paper and pencils and are assigned projects that engage them, she thinks most will respond positively to a break away from screens.
And for any of the adults, I know it's more convenient, definitely, to use the screens and assign homework, but it comes down to what's really benefiting the students, and that's paper-based learning.
Right now, Pulaski's plan is to eliminate one-on-one assigned Chromebooks for elementary students over the next 4 years. Students will still have access to technology, but the youngest children will do most of their schoolwork away from screens. In Pulaski, I'm Roxy Todd.
For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy your Wednesday.